Carlos Castaneda's Tales of Power, Part 2, The Tonal and the Nawal. Chapter 6, no, Chapter 7, The Wings of Perception. Don Juan and I spent the whole day in the mountains. We left at dawn. He took me to four places of power, and at each one of them he gave me specific instructions on how to proceed towards the fulfillment of the particular task that he had outlined years before as a life situation for me. We returned in the late afternoon after eating. Don Juan left Don Gennaro's house. He told me that I had to wait for Pablito, who was bringing some kerosene for the lantern, and that I should talk to him. I became utterly absorbed in working on my notes and did not hear Pablito come in until he was next to me. Pablito's comment was that he had been practicing the gate of power, and because of that, I could not possibly have heard him unless I was capable of seeing. I'd always liked Pablito. I had not, however, had very many opportunities in the past to be alone with him. Although we were good friends, Pablito had struck me as... Oh, here goes my computer down the ridge here. Come on, buddy, stay up here, will you? Was that he had been practicing... Oh, okay. I'd always liked Pablito. I had not, however, had very many opportunities in the past to be alone with him. Although we were good friends, Pablito had always struck me as being a most charming person. His name, of course, was Pablo, but the diminutive Pablito suited him better. He was small-boned but wiry. Like Don Gennaro, he was lean, unsuspectingly muscular, and strong. He was perhaps in his late 20s, but it seemed like he was 18. He was dark and of medium height. His brown eyes were clear and bright, and like Don Gennaro, he had a winning smile with a touch of devilish in it. Devilishness. I asked him about his friend Nesta, Don Gennaro's other apprentice. In the past, I'd always seen them together, and they had always given me the impression of having an excellent rapport with each other. Yet they were opposites in physical appearance and character. While Pablito was jovial and frank, Nesta was gloomy and withdrawn. He was also taller, heavier, darker, and much older. Pablito said that Nesta had finally become involved in his work with Don Gennaro, and that he had changed into an altogether different person since the last time I had seen him. He did not want to elaborate any further on Nesta's work or change of personality, and abruptly shifted the topic of conversation. "I understand the Nawal is biting your heels," he said. I was surprised that he knew, and I asked how he had found that out. "Gennaro tells me everything," he said. I noticed that he did not speak of Don Gennaro in the formal way I did. He simply called him Gennaro in a familiar fashion. He said that Don Gennaro was like his brother and that they were at ease around each other as though they were family. He openly professed that he loved Don Gennaro dearly. I was deeply moved by his simplicity and candor. In talking to him, I realized how close in temperament Don Juan and I were. Thus, our relationship was formal and strict in comparison to Don Gennaro and Pablito's. Excuse me. I asked Pablito why he was afraid of Don Juan. His eyes flickered. It was as if the mere thought of Don Juan made him wince. He did not answer. He seemed to be assessing me in some mysterious way. "You're not afraid of him?" he asked. I told him I was afraid of Don Gennaro, and he laughed as if it was the last thing he expected to hear. He said that the difference between Don Juan and Don Gennaro was like the difference between day and night. Don Gennaro was the day, Don Juan was the night, and as such, he was the most frightening being on earth. Describing his fear for Don Juan led Pablito to make some comments about his own condition as an apprentice. "Hello, Miss Daisy. I'm in the most miserable state," he said. "If you could see what's in my house, you would realize that I know too much for an ordinary man. And yet, if you saw me with the now wow, you would realize that I don't know enough. He quickly changed the subject and began to laugh at my taking notes. He said that Don Juan had provided hours of fun and imitating me. He added that Don Gennaro liked me very much in spite of the oddities of my person, and that he had expressed his delight in my being a protegido. That was the first time I had heard that term. It was congruous with another term introduced by Don Juan at the beginning of our association. He had called me, he had told me that I was his escogido, the chosen one. The word protegido means the protected one. Protegido, yeah, close enough. I asked Pablito about his meetings with the Nahual, and he told me the story of his first encounter with it. He said that once Don Juan gave him a basket, which he took to be a gift of goodwill. He placed it on a hook over the door of his room, and since he could not conceive any use for it at that moment, he forgot about it all day. He said that his idea was that the basket was a gift of power and had to be put to use with something very special. During the early evening, which Pablito said was his deadly hour also, he walked into his room to get his jacket. He was alone in the house and was getting ready to go visit a friend. The room was dark. He grabbed the jacket, and when he was about to reach the door, the basket fell in front of him and rolled near his feet. Pablito said that he laughed his fright away as soon as he saw that it was only the basket that had fallen from the hook. He leaned over to pick it up and got the jolt of his life. The basket jumped out of his reach and began to shake and squeak as if someone were twisting and pressing down on it. Pablito said that there was enough light coming from the kitchen to clearly distinguish everything in the room. He stared at the basket for a moment, although he felt he should not do that. The basket began to convulse in the midst of some heavy, rasping, and difficult breathing. Pablito maintained in recounting his experience that he actually saw and heard the basket breathing, and that it was alive and chased him around the room, blocking his exit. He said that the basket began to swell. All the strips of bamboo came loose and turned into a giant ball, like a dry tumbleweed that rolled toward him. He fell backwards on the floor and the ball began to crawl onto his feet. Pablito said that by that time, he was out of his mind, screaming hysterically. The ball had him trapped and moved up his legs like pins going through him. He tried to push it away and then noticed that the ball was the face of Don Juan and his mouth open, ready to devour him. At that point, he could not stand the terror and lost his consciousness. Pablito, in a very frank and open manner, told me a series of terrifying encounters that he had and other members of his household had with the Nahual. He spent hours talking. He seemed to be in very much the same quandary that I was in, but was definitely more sensitive than I in handling himself within the sorcerer's frame of reference. At one moment, he got up and said that he felt Don Juan was coming and he did not want to be found there. He took off with incredible speed. It was as if something had pulled him out of the room. He left me in the middle of saying goodbye. Don Juan and Don Gennaro came back shortly. They were laughing. Pablito was running down the road like a soul chased by the devil, Don Juan said. I wonder why. I think he got frightened when he saw Carlitos working his fingers to the bone, Don Gennaro said, mocking my writing. He came closer to me. Hey, I've got an idea, he said, almost in a whisper. Since you like to write so much, why don't you learn to write with your finger instead of a pencil? That'll be a blast. Yeah, the chipmunks there, Dave, somewhere. Don Juan and Don Gennaro sat by my side and laughed while they speculated about the possibility of writing with one's finger. Don Juan, in a serious tone, made a strange comment. He said, there is no doubt that he could write with his finger, but would he be able to read it? Don Gennaro doubled up with laughter and added, I am confident that he can read anything. And then he began to tell a most disconcerting tale about a country bumpkin who became an important official during a time of political upheaval. Don Gennaro said that the hero of his story was appointed minister or governor or perhaps even president because there was no way of telling what people would do in their folly. Because of this appointment, he came to believe that he was indeed important and learned to put on an act. Don Gennaro paused and examined me with the air of a ham actor overplaying his part. He winked at me and moved his eyebrows up and down. He said that the hero of the story was very good at public appearances and could whip up a speech with no difficulty at all, but that his physician required that he read his speeches, and the man was illiterate. So he used his wits to outsmart everybody. He had a sheet of paper with something written on it and flashed it around whenever he gave a speech. And thus his efficiency and other good qualities were undeniable to all the country bumpkins. But one day a literate stranger came along and noticed that the hero was reading the speech while holding the sheet upside down. He began to laugh and pointed out the lie to everyone. Don Gennaro again paused for a moment and looked at me, squinting his eyes, and asked, do you think that the hero was caught? Not a chance. He faced everyone calmly and said, upside down? Why should the position of the sheet matter if you know how to read? And the bumpkins agreed with him. Sounds like politics these days. Don Juan and Don Gennaro both exploded into laughter. Don Gennaro patted me gently on the back. It was as if I were the hero of the story. I felt embarrassed and laughed nervously. I thought that perhaps there was a hidden meaning to it, but I did not dare to ask. Don Juan moved closer to me. He leaned over and whispered in my right ear, do you think it's funny? Don Gennaro also leaned over towards me and whispered in my left ear, what did he say? I had an automatic reaction to both questions and made an involuntary synthesis. Yes, I thought he asked, it's funny, I said. They were obviously aware of the effect of their maneuvers. They laughed until tears rolled down their cheeks. Don Gennaro, as usual, was more exaggerated than Don Juan. He fell backwards and rolled on his back a few yards away from me. He lay on his stomach, extending his arms and legs out, whirled around on the ground as though he were lying on a swivel. He whirled around until he got close to me and his foot touched mine. He sat up abruptly and smiled sheepishly. Don Juan was holding his sides. He was laughing very hard, and it seemed that his stomach hurt. After a while, they both leaned over and kept on whispering into my ears. I tried to memorize the sequence of their utterances, but after a futile effort, I gave up. There were too many. They whispered in my ears until I again had the sensation that I had been split in two. I became a mist, like the day before, a yellow glow that sensed everything directly. That is, I could know things. There were no thoughts involved. There were only certainties. And when I came into contact with the soft, spongy, bouncy feeling, which was outside of me and yet was part of me, I knew it was a tree. I sensed it was a tree by its odor. It did not smell like any specific tree that I could remember. Nonetheless, something in me knew that peculiar odor was the essence of tree. I did not have just the feeling that I knew, nor did I reason my knowledge out or shuffle clues around. I simply knew that there was something there in contact with me, all around me, a friendly, warm, compelling smell emanating from something which was neither solid nor liquid, but an undefined something else which I knew was a tree. I felt that by knowing it in that manner, I was tapping its essence. I was not repelled by it. It rather invited me to melt with it. It engulfed me, or I engulfed it. There was a bond between us, which was neither exquisite nor displeasing. The next sensation I could recollect with clarity was a wave of wonder and exultation. All of me vibrated. It was as if charges of electricity were going through me. They were not painful. They were pleasing, but in such an undetermined form that there was no way to categorize them. I knew nevertheless that whatever I was in contact with was the ground. Some part of me acknowledged with concise certainty that it was the ground. But the instant I tried to discern the infinitude of direct perceptions I was having, I lost all capacity to differentiate my perceptions. Then all of a sudden, I was myself again. I was thinking. It was such an abrupt transition that I thought I had woken up. Yet there was something in the way I felt that was not quite myself. I knew that there was indeed something missing before I fully opened my eyes. Excuse me, I looked around and I was still in a dream or having a vision of some sort. My thought processes, however, were not only impaired, but extraordinarily clear. I made a quick assessment. I had no doubt that Don Juan and Don Gennaro had induced my dreamlike state for a specific purpose. I seemed to be on the verge of understanding what that purpose was when something extraneous to me forced me to pay attention to my surroundings. It took me a long moment to orientate myself. I was actually lying on my stomach, and what I was lying on was a most spectacular floor. As I examined it, I could not avoid a feeling of awe and wonder. I could not conceive of what it was made of. Irregular slabs of unknown substance, which had been placed in a most intricate yet simple fashion. They had been put together, but were not stuck to the ground or to each other. They were elastic and gave when I attempted to pry them apart with my fingers. But once I released the tension, they went right back to their original position. I tried to get up and was seized by the most outlandish sensory distortion. I had no control over my body. In fact, my body did not seem to be my own. It was inert. I had no connection to any of its parts, and when I tried to stand up, I could not move my arms, and I wobbled helplessly on my stomach, rolling on my side. The momentum of my wobbling also made me do a complete turn onto my stomach again. My outstretched arms and legs prevented me from turning over, and I came to rest on my back. In that position, I caught a glimpse of two strangely shaped legs and the most distorted feet I had ever seen. It was my body. I seemed to be wrapped up in a tunic, and the thought that came to my mind was that I was experiencing a scene of myself as a cripple or an invalid of some sort. I tried to curve my back and look at my legs, but I could only jerk my body. I was looking directly at a yellow sky, a deep, rich, lemon yellow sky. It had grooves or canals of a deeper yellow tone and an endless number of protuberances that hung like drops of water. The total effect of the incredible sky was staggering. I could not determine if the protuberances were clouds. There were also areas of shadows and areas of different tones of yellow, which I discovered as I moved my head from side to side. There was something else attracted my attention. A sun at the very zenith of the yellow sky right over my head. A mild sun, judging by the fact that I could stare into it, that cast a soothing, uniform, whitish light. Before I had time to ponder upon all these unearthly sights, I was violently shaken. My head jerked and bobbed back and forth. I felt I was being lifted. I heard a shrill voice and giggling, and I was confronted by a most astounding sight. A gigantic barefoot female. Her face was round and enormous. Her black hair was cut in pageboy fashion. Her arms and legs were gigantic. She picked me up and lifted me to her shoulders as if I were a doll. My body hung limp. I was looking down her strong back. She had a fine, don't knock my cord off, Daisy. She had a fine fuzz around her shoulders and down her spine. Looking down from her shoulder, I saw the magnificent floor again. I could hear it giving elastically under her enormous weight, and I could see the pressure marks her feet left on it. She put me down on my stomach and in front of a structure, some sort of building. I noticed that there was something wrong with my depth perception. I could not figure out the size of the building by looking at it. At moments, it seemed ridiculously small, and then after I seemingly adjusted my perception, I truly marveled at its monumental proportions. The giant girl sat next to me and made the floor squeak. I was touching her enormous knee. She smelled like candy or strawberries. She talked to me, and I understood everything she said. Pointing to the structure, she told me that I was going to live there. My prowess of observation seemed to increase as I got over the initial shock of finding myself there. I noticed then that the building had four exquisite dysfunctional columns. They did not support anything. They were on top of the building. Their shape was simplicity itself. They were long and graceful projections that seemed to be reaching for the awesome, incredibly yellow sky. The effect of those inverted columns was sheer beauty to me. I had a seizure of aesthetic rapture. The columns seemed to have been made in one piece. I could not even conceive how. The two columns in front were joined by a slender beam, a monumentally long rod that I thought may have served as a railing of some sort or a veranda overlooking the front. The giant girl made me slide on my back into the structure. The roof was black and flat and was covered with symmetric holes that let the yellowish glare of the sky show through, creating the most intricate patterns. I was truly awed with the utter simplicity and beauty that had been achieved by those dots of yellow sky showing through those precise holes in the roof. And the patterns of the shadows that they created on the magnificent and intricate floor. The structure was square. And outside of its poignant beauty, it was incomprehensible to me. My state of exaltation was so intense at that moment that I wanted to weep or stay there forever. But some force or tension or something indefinable began to pull me. Suddenly, I found myself out of the structure, still lying on my back. The giant girl was there, but there was another being with her. A woman so big that she reached to the sky and eclipsed the sun. Compared to her, the giant girl was just a little girl. The big woman was angry. She grabbed the structure by one of its columns, lifted it up and turned it upside down, and set it on the floor. It was a chair. That realization was like a catalyst. It triggered some overwhelming perceptions. I went through a series of images that were disconnected, but could be made to stand as a sequence. In successive flashes, I saw or realized that the magnificent and incomprehensible floor was a straw mat. The yellow sky was the stucco ceiling of a room. The sun was a light bulb. The structure that had evoked such rapture in me was a chair that a child, had turned upside down to play house. I had one more coherent and sequential vision of another mysterious architectural structure of monumental proportions. It stood by itself. It looked almost like a shell of a pointed snail standing with its tail up. The walls were made of concave and convex plates of some strange purple metal. Each plate had grooves that seemed to be more functional than ornamental. I examined the structure meticulously and in detail and found that it was, like the case of the previous one, thoroughly incomprehensible. I expected suddenly to adjust my perception to disclose the true nature of the structure, but nothing of the sort happened. I then had a conglomerate of alien and inextricable awareness or findings about the building and its function, which did not seem to make sense, because I had no frame of reference for them. I regained my normal awareness, and all of a sudden, Don Juan and Don Gennaro were next to me. I was tired. I looked at my watch. It was gone. Don Juan and Don Gennaro giggled in unison. Don Gennaro said that I should not worry about time, that I should concentrate on following certain recommendations that Don Gennaro had made to me. I turned to Don Gennaro, and he made a joke. He said that the most important recommendation was that I should learn to write with my... What are you doing, Daisy? All right. That I should learn to write with my finger to save on pencils and show off, and to show off. They teased me about my notes for a while longer, and then I went to sleep. Don Juan and Don Gennaro listened to the detailed account of my experience, which I gave them at Don Juan's request after I woke up the next day. Gennaro feels that you've got enough for the time being, Don Juan said after I finished talking. Don Gennaro assented with a nod. What was the meaning of what I experienced last night, I asked. You caught a glimpse of the most important issue of sorcery, Don Juan said. Last night you peeked into the totality of yourself. But that's, of course, a meaningless statement for you at this moment. Obviously, arriving at the totality of oneself is not a matter of one's desire to agree or one's willingness to learn. Gennaro thinks that your body needs time to let the whispering of the Nawa sink into you. Don Gennaro nodded again. Plenty of time, he said, shaking his head up and down. 20 or 30 years, perhaps. I did not know how to react. I looked at Don Juan for clues. They both had serious expressions. Do I really have 20 or 30 years, I asked. Of course not, Don Gennaro yelled, and they broke into laughter. Don Juan said that I should return whenever my inner voice told me to, and that in the meantime, I should try to assemble all the suggestions that they had made while I was split. How do I do that, I asked. By turning off your internal dialogue and letting something in you flow out and expand, Don Juan said. That something is your perception. Do not try to figure out what I mean. Just let the whispering of the Nawal guide you. Then he said that the night before I had had two sets of intrinsically different views. One was inexplicable, and the other was perfectly natural. And the order in which they had happened pointed to a condition that was intrinsic to all of us. One view was the Nawal, the other the Tonal, Don Gennaro added. I wanted him to explain his statement. He looked at me and patted me on the back. Don Juan stepped in and said that the first two views were the Nawal, and that Don Gennaro had selected a tree and the ground as points of emphasis. The other two were views of the Tonal that he himself had selected. One of them was my perception of the world as an infant. It appeared to be an alien world to you because your perception had not been trimmed yet to fit the desired mold, he said. Was that the way I really saw the world, I asked. Certainly, he said. That was your memory. I asked Don Juan whether the feeling of aesthetic appreciation that had enraptured me was also part of my memory. We go into those views as we are today, he said. You were seeing that scene as you would see it now. Yet the exercise was one of perception. That was the scene of a time when the world became for you what it is now, a time when a chair became a chair. He did not want to discuss the other scene. That wasn't the memory of my childhood, I said. That's right, he said. It was something else. What was it, something that I will see in the future, I asked. There's no future, he exclaimed cuttingly. The future is only a way of talking. For a sorcerer, there is only here and now. He said that there was essentially nothing to say about it because the purpose of the exercise had been to open the wings of my perception, and that although I had not flown on those wings, I had nonetheless touched four points which would be inconceivable to reach from the point of view of my ordinary perception. I began to gather my things to leave. Don Gennaro helped me pack my notebook. He put it in the bottom of my briefcase. It'll be warm and cozy there, he said and winked. You can rest assured that it won't catch cold. Then Don Gennaro seemed to change his mind about my leaving and started to talk about my experience. I automatically tried to grab my briefcase from Don Gennaro's hands, but it had dropped to the floor before I touched it. Don Juan was talking with his back turned to me. I scooped up the briefcase and hurriedly searched for my notebook. Don Gennaro had really packed it so tightly that I had a hellish time getting to it. Finally, I took it out and began to write. Don Juan and Don Gennaro were staring at me. "You are in terrible shape," Don Juan said, laughing. "You reach for a notebook as a drunkard reaches for the bottle. As a loving mother reaches for her child," Don Gennaro snapped. "As a priest reaches for his crucifix," Don Juan added. "As a woman reaches for her panties," Don Gennaro yelled. They went on and on, presenting similes and howling with laughter as they walked me to my car. End of chapter.